Wife Chandra denied the allegations against her husband.
This is a cruel miscarriage of justice. It's a cruel, totally unjustified, and he's innocent of the lies.
A woman who took her toddler son to Syria has been found guilty of joining so-called Islamic State and encouraging terrorism through social media. Tarina Shakil from Birmingham denied the charges, saying she travelled there to live a pure Muslim life under Sharia law. Marcus Beale from West Midlands Police says her son appeared in a propaganda picture.
He was put in a substantial danger. It's in a chaotic war zone. That is no place for a young British citizen to be. He is now back in the UK. He is safe.
Former Dragon's Den star Doug Richard has left the Old Bailey in tears after being cleared of child sex offences. The 57-year-old chatted with a 13-year-old he met on a sugar daddy website and then engaged in role play when they met up. The American millionaire told jurors he thought she was 17. HSBC says its internet and mobile banking services are now partially up and running. The bank's revealed hackers are still attacking it and it's closely monitoring the situation. Winds of more than 100 miles per hour have left thousands of homes without power, damaged buildings and disrupted transport. Orkney and Shetland remain on the highest level of alert. Four miners who've been stuck underground in China for more than a month have been rescued. One man was killed when the mine collapsed on Christmas Day. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
The Bristol Cable is out now. Look out for one of 10,000 free copies across the city. There's investigations, local voices, debates and infographics. The Bristol Cable is local media worth reading. And you can own part of it for as little as £1 a month. And you get a direct say, free training and discounts in local businesses. So if you're fed up with mainstream media, why not read, create or own something different? The Bristol Cable, a refreshing look at the news. Pick up a copy today or visit the Bristol Cable.
BCFM. Well,
it's Friday, 5 o'clock, or just after, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news is Green Councillor for Clifton East, Carla Denyer. Is that right, Carla? Have I pronounced that right?
You have, yes.
Makes a change. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, whispering "Omerta, Omerta" under his breath. Are we being ruled by a bunch of the country's most thuggish toffs from Eton and the Bullingdon Club? Journalist Nick Much recently graduated from Oxford and he didn't like what he saw there. Plus, 10 years after the Chief Inspector of Schools recommended all Bristol schools be privatised, and they were, where are we now? We hear from independent mayor candidate and former teacher Christine Townsend. And does any real international terrorist threat really exist? That's the provocative question put by someone Martin Summers speaks of regularly on this show, General Leonid Ivashov, former head of the Russian Armed Forces. We look at his statement as well as dig deeper into the 1999 Russian blocks of flats apartment bombings that the polonium poisoned spy Alexander Litvinenko wrote all about and then he blamed Vladimir Putin. That in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight lows of 7 Celsius, heavy showers. This weekend highs of 11, sunnier but colder on Saturday, warmer but wet and windy though on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11, that's plenty of wet and windy weather with more sunshine midweek. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of February, highs of 10 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Clifton East, Carla Denyer. Hi, Carla. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there.
Let's start by if you just explain to us how things are going up in Clifton, because that's where you represent. What's it? One thinks of this as a sort of safe Tory seat, or Lib Dems at least.
Yeah, I think I surprised a lot of people when I got in this May, but didn't surprise those who'd been paying attention, I guess. It's been Lib Dem for the last little while, but I represent Clifton East, which is the area near White Ladies Road, which is less the sort of posh Clifton village that most people think of when they hear Clifton, and it's more the area where a lot of the city's students live. Students make up over 30% of my ward. There's also a lot of young professionals who recently graduated, and I think quite a lot of university academics live there as well. And as you might imagine, quite a lot of those people are likely to be a little on the left-wing side and seriously consider voting Green.
How long have you been in place then?
Just since May 2015.
Well, that's... it's not really fair, is it? Because you've only had a year, and now you've got to have a go at getting re-elected, because they're doing every single ward, aren't they, in the city this May?
That's right. I did know what I was getting myself in for when I stood in 2015. In fact, at the time, it even seemed like a good idea, because it gave me a chance of a year of try before you buy, if you like, to make sure that I definitely enjoyed being a councillor before standing for the whole 4 years. But I do, and I am. But you're right, it's come around very quickly, and the idea of starting campaigning again already seems a bit crazy.
So tell me about some of the experiences you've had since you became a councillor. This is sitting on committees. I mean, have you actually ever seen any power being really exercised? Because you councillors don't have a lot of power, that's what we're told. The mayor has it all.
That's right, yeah. Since Bristol's had the mayoral system, we have a lot less power than we did. But there are still some areas where councillors get to make decisions. One of those is on planning committees, and I sit on one of the two planning committees for the city. So planning and licensing are decisions that are made by those committees, and they can affect the future of the city quite considerably.
Well, what about, I mean, planning's a biggie, isn't it? Because there's been a lot of chat. I mean, I was looking recently at, and I'm trying to get an interview at the moment actually with some of the councillors and people involved with big planning decision over at near Cirencester. I know it's a bit out of our area, but it's an enormous great planning application for lots and lots of homes by Earl Bathurst, which will almost increase by another quarter the size of the town of Cirencester. There are enormous decisions going through at the moment and big changes to planning, whereas you or I, if we wanted to build a house, there's no chance we would get planning permission to do it. So tell us about some of the decisions that you've seen on the committee there.
Well, some are quite small. It is just an ordinary person extending their house, or... sometimes it is someone building a house, often in Bristol, because Bristol's already quite densely populated. Those are infill developments where somebody with a large back garden is building a house at the end of the garden. And that can be quite controversial, but...
Well, it's controversial for the neighbours. If you buy a house and then decide, right, I'm going to sell off the tail end of the garden for someone else to build a house on it, well, you're really a property developer, property speculator, and so many people are doing this with land now.
They are, and... unfortunately, the rules for what counts as a material planning consideration, so what we're legally allowed to consider in planning application cases, is very restricted. So one of the things that isn't protected is your right to a view. So your right to light is protected. So if a building was built so tall next to your house that it blocked the light into your living room, then that's a reason to object, and it may well be blocked on that basis. But unless you own all the land around your house, you are not allowed to object to anybody blocking your view, unfortunately.
What about general policy-wise? What is the green vision for the city? Because we often... I mean, most of the other main parties have got some kind of idea, but I think for the Greens, it's a little bit difficult to discern. How do the Greens and your party see the city, say, in 10 years' time?
Well, we don't think it's that difficult to discern. We've got some... pretty core priorities. Housing, obviously we're not the only ones saying this, but housing is really, really important.
Well, everybody's saying it, but no one's doing anything.
Well, yeah, we're very frustrated about that. The number of council houses, for example, that Bristol has built in the last few years is frankly shocking.
But it's a bit annoying, isn't it? When rather than actually doing anything, the political parties are all competing to be more frustrated than the others that they can't do anything.
Yeah, it's very irritating.
Do you see any way of getting decent housing, affordable housing? Well, I say affordable. That doesn't even mean affordable anymore. We're in this Orwellian world of affordable housing being something you can't afford. But social housing, effectively, where people can rent a reasonable amount.
Yeah, so I'm going to drag it back to planning again, because that's what I know. Every new housing development in Bristol is meant to consist of at least 30% affordable or social housing. It's higher in certain areas of the city. But for very frustrating reasons, that doesn't always happen, because sometimes the developer manages to persuade planning committees, and I'm not just talking about Bristol here, I'm talking about nationally, that the site isn't financially viable to have affordable housing on it, and there's this viability statement that they can produce. But I always do my best to push against that, because it's so important.
Well, I mean, what the big developers are doing now is they're saying, oh, we're very sorry, but we can't build any of these affordable houses. It's all going to have to be luxury flats. Sorry about that, Carla.
Yeah, it's really infuriating, but we have had a few successes and a few big-ish developments. I'm not talking whole new town-sized ones like in Cirencester, but there have been some applications that have gone through the committee lately that have included social housing, and I just hope there's going to be more like that, and that the you may have heard about the joint spatial plan that the council's been consulting on. The consultation closed last night, I think, and theoretically that is going to result in a better and more effective housing plan for the city. Don't hold me to that, though.
Yeah, don't hold your breath, I thought you were going to say. Martin, what can we do about this? Well, we've just got some economic figures figures on the economy this week. Apparently, is it, I think, 0.2% growth, and everyone's sort of, well, certainly the Conservative Party are cheering about it. But I saw a great piece in the Guardian yesterday. It popped up yesterday afternoon, where it says official figures for GDP growth in the final 3 months for 2015 show that the backbone of the economy, economic activity, stuff of making and building things, actually shrank. So it's only by looking at financial services and the financial sector and the stock market, basically, where this growth is coming from. So is there actually really any growth or not?
Well, and the property market, of course. What we've got now is what we've always had in Britain, which is this kind of rentier economy. If you get your foot on the housing ladder, then you basically get free money. And but at the same time, and that all goes into the GDP figures and supposedly increased economic activity. But it's essentially an illusion, and it's going to end in tears. It will crash. But of course, the people who make money out of these property bubbles, and there's this minority, a substantial minority of the population do, they basically get the free money from the system the way it's constituted. And another pernicious aspect of this, of course, is if people don't get stable households, they're much less likely to register to vote. And we know that there were less people registered to vote in Bristol and across the country at the last election than the previous election, even though the population has increased. So you've got lots of people who are constantly on the move in multi-occupancy tenancies, in private sector, the private rented sector. They are the least likely to register to vote. And therefore, of course, the system works in such a way that their interests are simply not represented in the way decisions are taken about housing.
Well, I noticed Finsel's Reach. I was walking past there, see, around the old sort of brewery site next to Bristol Bridge. I know the original company that was going to be developing all that into flats collapsed. I think it was a couple of years ago. They seem to be sort of building them again. And as I walked along, actually a security guard came out to say, are you looking to buy one of these? They seem to be absolutely desperate to sell them, and they're not selling a lot of the ones that have already been built. I think this is a problem across the country, particularly in the south of England, Carla. And everybody needs somewhere to live. We've got to get the housing market, I was going to say racket, no, the housing market sorted out so that people have got somewhere to live and they're not having to pay over the odds for it. If we're building properties in the city and we're approving planning permission for properties to be built, and then the previous ones that the house builders aren't selling, well, it's not really surprising that construction is down. They've got more permissions to build, but they're not selling the ones they've already built.
Yeah, I completely agree. The Finsel's Reach application was way before my time, I'm afraid, so I don't know the details of that. But yeah, it's completely frustrating. There are luxury flats and office buildings empty while other people are homeless. It's completely stupid. And jumping back to what you were saying, Martin, about GDP, I couldn't agree more. GDP is a stupid way of measuring what it's trying to measure, really, which is the country's well-being. For example, GDP would go up if we had a war, and that doesn't mean that we would be happier.
No. Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think we can. There's a tendency for some people to say that Greens and socialists like myself don't believe in economic growth. I believe in economic improvement and transformation, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to increase throughput of resources. You could, you know, we are constantly want to be improving what we do and increasing, making it better. But we don't necessarily want to use more stuff in doing that. And we need to make economic growth less resource intensive. And things like energy saving are far more important than people realise. You know, it's not a question of finding new technologies. The technology of energy saving is quite straightforward. We just haven't got the will to implement it.
This article, Carla, says Osborne is storing up a heap of trouble for the UK economy. Now, Martin has been on ever since we started this show. I think it was 2009, 2008 or something, has been banging on about there's going to be a crash. Eventually, what do you think is going to pull us out? Because although this is being painted as modest growth, actually the growth is only in the financial sector. In the real world, it's not growing at all.
Yeah, I don't think the way we're going is the way to do it, that's for sure. I think that investment is what's going to pull us out. The Green New Deal is a phrase you may have heard that we've been banging on about for a while, that you need to invest in infrastructure, and that means housing, it means transport, it means things that improve people's lives and help them get back to work if they're unemployed, or just improve their quality of life.
West councils are likely to raise taxes next year, the BBC has found. This is on BBC website from yesterday. All the councils in the west of England are likely to increase their taxes after several years of freezes. A BBC investigation has shown council tax is likely to increase by up to £65 in the west region. Highest rise of £65 in Somerset is partly due to a one-year interim levy for flood defence work that hadn't been done before. North Somerset's council tax is likely to go up £53. As expected, the rises in Gloucestershire £53, Bristol £60, South Gloucestershire £60. They all take into account police and fire services, which are expected to put up their share of the council tax bill. Now, Martin, I come to you first on this because we're getting less and less services. I know on this BBC report, they're saying that they're likely to go to 3 weekly bin connections in North Somerset, and yet we're being asked to pay more for less. And there'd been a council tax freeze for several years, but now they've said, OK, off you go, and they're starting to jack up what we have to pay. Of course, remembering that for most people, it's the same have to pay even if their income is virtually zero.
Well, that's the problem with council tax. It's essentially poll tax mark two. So it's registered. It's paid by individuals rather than registered.
Well, it's a regressive tax. It can be a massive amount of money to people with very little, but it's peanuts to those with a lot.
Well, yes, in Northern Ireland they still have the rates. So actually, the owners of property have to pay rates for local authority to the local authority, and most people. Ordinary people they may pay in their rent as a notional part of their rent to their landlord, but they don't actually pay any. The rates are raised on property, and the reason why they still have the rates in Northern Ireland because the introduction of the poll tax in the 1980s would have been like pouring petrol on a bonfire. They introduced the poll tax in Scotland, and of course it led to the rise of the Scottish National Party. They didn't even dare to try it in Northern Ireland. Because when they tried to collect the census in 1972, people who were collecting the census were assassinated. And if you could imagine bailiffs trying to go down the Falls or the Shankill Road to take away people's tellies, that would be an extremely dangerous occupation. So in actual fact, as a result of the war in Northern Ireland, they still have the good old-fashioned rates system, which means that only property owners pay towards local authority services.
Carla, the message here seems to be if you're poor, we're going to hit you hard. If you're rich, it's a pat on the back. What can the Green Party, if anything, do about this? It's quite obviously unjust.
Yeah, the council tax system is, as you said, it's a regressive tax, because although the amount you pay goes up with the value of your property, it doesn't go up in proportion to people's income these days, and so as a proportion of their income, it does affect the poor worse. What's really frustrating, though, is in the, despite what they're telling us, increasingly centralised government, the council has very little way of raising its own income other than council tax. So the government is cutting the money that it gives out to councils even faster than it's cutting its central departments and services. Eventually it's going to get so that Bristol is cut by 85% in a few years. So yes, Bristol, most of the West, and I think most of the councils in the country are going to have to raise their taxes. And it's basically we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. But what we are doing, as the Greens, is proposing to keep the council tax reduction scheme. So that's a scheme that used to be run by national government, which was to help those on the lowest incomes to pay their council tax so that it didn't affect them so much. That scheme, as funded by national government, ended in 2013. At the moment, Bristol City Council has picked up the tab and is paying it itself. That's guaranteed for another year, but not after that. So we're pushing really hard to make sure that Bristol carries on providing that for the poorer citizens.
Well, what about the mayor? Do you think he understands that this is unjust?
I hope so. I think he does. I don't know if it's his highest priority or not.
Gary, talking of poverty and social justice or injustice, Gary Neville's hotel for the homeless has closed its doors up in Manchester. It's estimated Gary Neville, the footballer, spent up to £150,000 of his own money on keeping the project going during the winter months. On this one, Martin, Gary Neville bought a building, I think it was a former Manchester Stock Exchange, and found that there were homeless people squatting in it in the run-up to Christmas, and he said rather than evict them, he would let them stay there over the Christmas period. But now he's ready to do the building up, and those people have got to find somewhere else to go. I mean, he's a private citizen shelling out £150,000 of his own cash to house the homeless people.
Well, I mean, it's commendable that Gary Neville took the attitude that he did, but he was obviously always in the business of doing this place up and making a profit from it. And, of course, you can't do that from homeless people, so they're now on the way out. It's a fundamental problem. The interaction between the electoral system and the policy of the government on housing, and let's just remember that Cameron the other day said he was going to knock down council estates across the country. What's he going to do with the people in those council estates? Nothing to say about that. So he certainly isn't saying we're going to knock down these council estates and we're going to rebuild them new, and all the people that live in them now can have the same houses back at the same at the same rent they're on now. In other words, what they're saying is we are going to take over basically prime development land, which have currently got council estates on it, and we're going to give it to our chums in the private sector to do the usual scams. And it is shocking in this country that people really think that the way to get ahead is, you know, you get your foot on the property ladder in your 20s and then you just get free money given to you by society. In other northern European countries, that simply isn't the case.
Well, how many 20-year-olds can actually get on the property
ladder? Well, they can't. I mean, some can, but they're a minority.
Actually, you know, for a lot of 18 to 24-year-olds, they can't even get a job.
Well, it's the 30-year-olds that now, but it's a scam, and it's very pernicious.
Yeah, this the closure of his hotel for the homeless is very sad, especially because, yes, I thought it was going to be keeping going during the winter months, and winter may well be a long way from being over, so I'm worried for those people.
What about our own city council, though? We've got a lot of property, we've got loads of buildings. Why not letting homeless people use those? In fact, possibly even writing to people who are on the housing list and saying, would you like to come and do these buildings up? Because I understand that the council has to spend quite a lot on things like security, clearing rubbish from them. It's going back a few years, but I can remember chatting to police in London saying it's a criminal waste to leave buildings like that empty.
Yeah, that's a good idea, and it has been done in other places. Forgive me, I can't remember which city, but a northern city did that recently, where it had some very run-down houses, which it sold for £1.
I think it's Liverpool.
Liverpool. Yeah. There we go, yeah. I think that would be a great idea. But as for the immediate future in Bristol, there has actually been an announcement, I think it was only yesterday or the day before, about more unused buildings being opened up for the homeless. So that's with existing organisations like St Mungo's, who've been working with the council over Christmas. A couple, literally only a few beds worth, were opened just around Christmas time, and then several tens more opened this week, and hopefully more later. The challenge is the running costs of these, more than finding the rooms, because they've got to be fully fitted out. You don't want to just bung someone in an empty room. But it's finding the revenue from somewhere to keep these going. And really, ultimately, we want to house people permanently, not in these temporary shelters.
Yeah, the story you're talking about, thanks for bringing it to my attention. It's empty buildings in Bristol will be turned into houses for the homeless. That was in yesterday's Bristol Post. More temporary accommodation for the homeless is opening in Bristol thanks to a new rough sleeping task group. Groups trying to get to the bottom of homelessness, and I don't quite know how you expect to do that. Were you looking for numbers or what? To provide extra resources for the vulnerable. Before Christmas, it was announced that 20 extra beds were being provided in conjunction with the charity St Mungo's, that recently announced that there's a crackdown on people sleeping in tents in parks across the city. This emergency accommodation is available for people who are assessed by the outreach team who are waiting for a place in a hostel. Offers a bed for the night while individual's housing plan is assessed. And now a number of other bed spaces will be made available over the coming weeks. Now, Martin, this comes alongside Bristol's homeless campers could have their tents confiscated and face court action. This is getting a little bit fascistic, isn't it? If someone is homeless, they've got nowhere to go, the only thing they can do is buy a £12 tent from Wilkinson's to spend the night under some sort of cover, and then they're then prosecuted and their tent is then stolen for their trouble. This is getting quite nasty.
It is, and don't forget that these people are very unlikely to be registered to vote. The only way of changing this is to change national policy. Part of the problem is why we've got a consensus in Bristol that something should be done about this across the board, including some Conservative councillors, but nothing can be done because government policy is to get rid of the social housing sector. That's quite clear. The Cameron coming out the other day and saying he's going to knock down existing council estates couldn't be clearer. Because what will happen when they've knocked those estates down is they will be redeveloped for those on the housing ladder. And if you're not on the housing ladder, I mean, basically, we're going back to Britain as it was in the 19th century, where a minority of people were householders and they were allowed to vote in elections, and everybody else was simply didn't count.
Well, the Sheriff of Nottingham in this case is Nick Hooper, Service Director for Housing Solutions, apparently. Yes. Criminalising the homeless, and crime reduction, actually increasing the amount of crime by criminalising the homeless. This is very, he's an Orwellian chap. Maybe we should invite him to come and have a chat on here. Bristol City Council, he said, as with other cities and towns in the UK, we're currently experiencing high levels of rough sleeping, and there's been an increase in rough sleepers, surprise, surprise, due to massive extra evictions, an increase in those due to the economy, including those sleeping in tents in the city this year. The council does not want to encourage large encampments in public parks and other public areas, as it often leads to complaints from the public about mess, littering and antisocial behaviour. Parks and public places are not designed for camping and do not have adequate facilities for campers, Carla.
Yeah, I'm speechless. I was really unimpressed and shocked by Nick Hooper's statement. I can't speak for all the councillors, but myself and the other Greens didn't know about this plan to evict all of the camping homeless from parks until this came out. I'm just completely shocked. Homeless people aren't the problem. The lack of homes is the problem. They shouldn't be criminalised. The suggestion he made that they should go back to sleeping in doorways, even less protected than the really minimal protection they can get from a tent in January, is ridiculous. My fellow Green councillor Annie Stafford Townsend, who's councillor for Cabot Ward, which covers the city centre and is where a lot of the homeless people sleep, She's also been really focusing on homelessness in the last few months, and she was the one that put the motion about opening empty office buildings to the council just before Christmas. So she and I spoke very soon after that article came out with Nick Cooper's quote, and I think she's going to be having a word with him sometime next week.
Yes, Nick Cooper's threatening. Well, no, he's rubbing his hands. The council will also remove unoccupied tents on council land and keep them in storage. Oh, really? So if someone has to nip down the road to get something to eat or drink and they don't take their tent with them, Nick Cooper's going to come and steal it.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the United States, of course, I mean, people living in huge tent cities has been the norm since the economic crisis broke in 2008 and long before. Ultimately, that is where Britain is going, because there is no provision being made for the bottom third of the population. And another pernicious thing, of course, is that universal credit, because of Ian Duncan Smith's desire to reform the behaviour of the undeserving poor, he's insisting that that housing benefits should not be paid to landlords, but should be paid directly to tenants, who will then pass it on to landlords so that they all learn to manage their own budgets. The only problem with that being that private landlords have made it absolutely clear that under those circumstances they will not take people on benefits. The biggest buy-to-let landowners in the southeast of England made it absolutely, their Tory donors said, if they change the rules like this, we are not only not going to rent to any more British people on benefits, we're going to evict our existing tenants, and we're going to replace them with East Europeans who are in work, who can pay the rent. So in other words, a whole section of British society is being told you can't get social housing, you can't get on the housing ladder, and now we're going to make it impossible for you to get private rented accommodation as well. And I'm afraid tents in the park is really the only option after that, isn't it?
I suppose what Nick Hooper's worried about here is that actually there's a massive housing crisis, and it, within the space of just a few weeks, you could end up with an enormous great tent city in Bristol, because there's just nowhere for people to go. One of the things he said in his statement was the situation is partly as a result of individuals and organisations, but not the council or its partners. Providing tents to assist people who are rough sleeping and help them shelter from winter weather. Both the council and St Mungo's fully understand the need for people to stay warm and dry when they're rough sleeping. Campers can feel more comfortable than if they were rough sleeping, therefore they may not engage with the council.
Yeah, well,
that's what you were saying, I guess, isn't it? You know, that he would rather that they were sleeping in the doorway, because then the council can get to them and they will engage more easily with the council. But, I mean, surely the priority is the person, not the council.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because there are problems with homeless people living in tents. They're less visible, as you say, and that's not... The council's perspective in that respect isn't we want to be able to see them so that we can arrest them. It's we want to be able to see them so that we can check they're okay. So the council works with organisations like St Mungo's and does regular patrols. Sometimes the people living on the streets, they're not all there because there aren't enough beds. Some of them will refuse to go into shelters because of a bad experience they've had in the past. And this is obviously tragic, but if you can't convince them, then you just have to do the regular rounds every night and make sure they're okay and bring them anything they need.
But there have been reports, though, that when St Mungo's go round, that they're making notes of things like people's eligibility to stay in the country. So it's not just we're looking after you, it may be that you get then reported to the authorities, arrested and deported.
Yeah, I heard that news as well, and one of my colleagues contacted St Mungo's and the relevant people in the council, the officers, straight away to ask about that, and they don't know where that news story came from. So I agree it's shocking, but we couldn't find any evidence that that had actually happened.
I think what may be happening, and this is really just a guess, but it's that St Mungo's at least know where people are staying, because the council for a long time hasn't known. It's come up with figures which are much, much smaller than really the real figure of rough sleepers. And so as people start to engage with St Mungo's, then they start to know where people are staying, and then the other parts of the authorities can then know, not necessarily individuals, but parts of the city, to look for rough sleepers, possibly to deport them. Anyway, let's leave that for the time being. I'm sure that one is not going to go away. Rising, the tent city, idea of tent cities, since we're living in a world where there's more and more people being made homeless and they need somewhere, obviously, to sleep. I think the Bristol City parks seem to be a very sensible place if you've got nowhere else to go. Rising rents and low wages fuel a £25 billion housing benefit bill. A report from the Centre for City's think tank shows welfare spending growing rapidly in the most prosperous parts of Britain. In a report, it calculates that almost 1 million jobs have been created in the UK cities, but average annual wages have dropped by £1,300 per person, making it more difficult for workers to make ends meet. Now, Martin, housing benefit is still growing, even though George Osborne has said, no, we want to cut this bill, and in fact, he's making it more and more difficult for people to claim the housing support that they're entitled to.
Well, it's a perfect storm, isn't it? I mean, in the past, it was widely understood across the political spectrum, and it was the Tory government in the 1950s that built the most council houses in Britain, the Macmillan government, that if you're going to have a free market economy with the differentials of wages, the bottom third of the population simply will not earn enough to be able to independently buy access to reasonable housing. So that the council housing sector was created to plug that gap, and incidentally to prevent property bubbles. Because if you've got a solid council housing sector, it means people have got a real choice about whether to get on the property ladder or not. And the British economy is actually incredibly hamstrung by this rentier housing bubble approach to running the economy.
But then you've also got a completely broken system with housing benefit, haven't you, where you've got people's amounts that they're getting in every week is going up and down with 0 hours contracts. And the housing benefit people have got to almost calculate your housing benefit, Carl, week by week.
Exactly. So you've got a huge bureaucracy that has to administer it. And most people claiming housing benefit are in work. So we were not talking about the so-called shirkers. We're talking, I mean, they're more simple to deal with because at least you know exactly how much they've got. They're not earning anything. But the whole system, you know, people complain about paying this housing benefit bill. That's the other side of getting all of your free money when you get on the housing ladder. I was talking to people at lunchtime today. They're buying their council houses over in Lowell West. They're going to be given tens of thousands of pounds by the government. Nice work if you can get it. But why should the rest of us subsidise those individuals to buy their houses at a non-market rate? It's a farrago of nonsense. It's a scam, and it really undermines the macroeconomic stability of the country because these housing bubbles are incredibly destructive for manufacturing industry in Britain. It's not just a shame for the homeless. It's actually undermining our export potential.
Yeah, the whole housing benefit and general housing system is a scandal. One thing that I know you're a fan of, Martin, and I am as well, is citizens' income. So we were talking about this just before we came on air. Citizens' income is a Green Party long-standing policy, which doesn't get talked about a huge amount. And when it does, it gets a bit of stick sometimes because it's not that well presented by the media, but it's basically...
Well, or by Natalie Bennett, I think. She didn't really know the figures, and I'm just thinking, because wasn't it discussed famously in the run-up to last year's general election, and she couldn't quite back it up economically and with the figures for it. How she would pay for it, basically.
I thought that was social housing numbers rather than citizens' income. I might be wrong, but I don't think we should hate on her too much for that. It was basically her getting a digit wrong somewhere, and long strings of numbers are difficult to remember in the morning, so I think that was fair enough. But yeah, citizens' income basically is the idea that every citizen gets an income, which is not loads, it's not a fortune, but it's enough to live on. And that means that they're then free to follow whatever vocation they want without having to take a muck job.
But we're going in totally the opposite direction. As we hear, as this report has said, and this was in The Independent on Monday this week, it's £1,300 per person is now the average annual wage drop. So most wages have gone down by £1,300. So every time you hear the Prime Minister and others say how wonderful it is we've got so many more jobs, well, actually, the average that people are getting for those is way, way less than it was before. So, Martin, what is going on here? Because it looks to me as if we're all being victims of some sort of employment racket, where, yes, you can have a job, but that job is not going to give you enough money to bring up your family, pay the wages, pay the electricity and the gas.
Well, the other thing is that productivity per worker has collapsed. So in actual fact, we're doing nothing to prepare people for the high-tech future, which everybody claims we're going to have. And ultimately, of course, we're creating, you know, Bill Gates and others have talked about robots and mechanization. We're you know, even the most skilled jobs can be done by computers. And unless we rethink our relationship to work and what it's all about, there's going to be a social explosion. And of course, this property bubble will burst. There's a global property bubble, but it's particularly bad in Britain. It will burst, and then of course we really will be facing a situation where as Oxfam's report recently pointed out, you know, a tiny fraction of the world's population controls a huge proportion of the world's wealth.
At the other end of the scale, GE Healthcare, US healthcare giant, makes a fortune from the National Health Service but pays hardly a penny in tax. This was actually just about a week ago, again in The Independent. One of the biggest suppliers of equipment and testing services to the NHS pays barely any corporation tax in the UK, despite receiving hundreds of millions of pounds a year from medical sales to British clinics and hospitals. A study of GE Healthcare's accounts by The Independent suggests it's received more money back in tax benefits over the last 12 years than it's paid in. So this is the richest, most powerful multinational companies in the world. They are paying none. No, in fact, in this case, taxes even going in the opposite direction. They're getting some kind of tax credits that George Osborne doesn't want to give to single mums. This month it announced GE was moving its global headquarters from Connecticut of more than 40 years to Boston after cash-strapped Connecticut closed corporate tax loopholes. GE said it had been considering the move before the tax rise, but the state's clampdown is reported to have hastened its departure. It's also moved away, that's the reason they did this report, from Amersham, which it's been based in since the 1940s. Because that we're starting to clamp down on tax for these multinationals, so it's moving out of the country. Carla, it's just one law for them and another law for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Despite the threat of them moving out, I think we need to close all of these tax loopholes. It's completely ridiculous to have a go at so-called benefit cheats who number very small, and where they do exist, take a very small amount of money compared to these huge companies. And frankly, if closing the tax loopholes means that they go elsewhere, as Caroline Lucas said in an interview recently, good riddance, and I'll help them pack their bags.
OK, now this isn't the most famous story this week. Google's probably the most famous one, which has been managing to negotiate its tax down. I was going to say dodging tax, but no, it's gone to 20-something meetings. I noticed on Question Time, one of the audience made a great comment, which I thought was wonderful anyway, which was, when I want to talk to the HMRC, I have to sit and wait on the phone for an hour, whereas they're making nice little meetings with Google. Of course, these big multinational companies seem to be able to basically... They're a bit like the suicide bombers, Martin, aren't they? They sit there and they say, well, look, we're just going to leave. Unless you do as we say, Mr. Cameron, we're leaving the country, or we're going to destroy your tax revenues or whatever. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now. Go back to Wednesday to have a listen to Prime Minister's Questions, where the whole Google thing came up with Prime Minister's Questions, where Jeremy Corbyn asked a question about that to the Prime Minister, David Cameron.
Speaker, that the Prime Minister is the Prime Minister, is responsible to government, and therefore is responsible for tax collection. Mr. Speaker, Google made profits of £6 billion in the UK between 2005 and 2015, and is paying £130 billion in tax for the whole of that decade. Millions of people this week are filling in their tax returns to get them in by the 31st. They have to send the form back. They do not get the option of 25 meetings with 17 ministers to decide what their rate of tax is. Many people going to their HMRC offices or returning them online this week will say this: why is there one rule for big multinational companies and another for ordinary small businesses and self-employed workers?
All those people filling in their tax returns are going to be paying lower taxes under this government. That is what's happening. And I have to say to him, he can, if he wants, criticise HMRC, but HMRC's work is investigated by the National Audit Office, and when they did that, they found that the settlements that they've reached with companies are fair. That is how it works. Now, the Shadow Chancellor's pointing. The Shadow Chancellor. The idea that those two right honourable gentlemen would stand up to anyone in this regard is laughable. Look at the record over the last week. They met with the unions and they gave them flying pickets. They met with the Argentinians, they gave them the Falkland Islands. They met with a bunch of migrants in Calais, they said they could all come to Britain. The only people they never stand up for are the British people and hard-working taxpayers.
Well, that's a pretty shabby response by Cameron there to what was a serious question. And of course, the fact is, if Google don't pay their taxes, somebody else has to make up that shortfall. That would be the people on PAYE. So it's all pretty ludicrous. Coming back to this GE Healthcare, who haven't paid their taxes. If the National Health Service was a proper National Health Service as it used to be, without being contracted out to US multinationals, the questions of them paying or not paying taxes wouldn't arise. And incidentally, we could think about things like nationalising the pharmaceutical industry, because a lot of the money we spend in the NHS is actually money that we pay to pharmaceutical companies because of their patents and all the rest of it. And the logical thing to do with that has been put forward quite straightforwardly by economists all over the world, is nationalise the pharmaceutical industry. And of course, nobody talks like that, do they? The people don't understand how the economy works, and they don't understand the scams that are run, and therefore they can then be trapped into this ludicrous stuff about people stealing from them who are on benefits, when the real thieves are actually at the top of the chain.
Carla, one of the other aspects of this is that this was some sort of voluntary revelation by Google, apparently, that these sorts of sweetheart deals, this is one of the only ones that's come out. Nobody's really going to be knowing in the future about this sort of thing. And we have to count ourselves lucky that we've actually got the facts in this case. There are other deals are going on behind the scenes with George Osborne and the HMRC that no one is ever going to know about.
Yeah, I'm sure there are other deals going on like this, and it's really shocking. The idea that Google can kindly offer to pay whatever it feels like paying is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find that actual story, because it's quite... I just think it's pretty shocking that these basic facts, they're going to try and deny them to us in the future about how much, you know, people like Google are actually able to do that. But I can't find the story right now. Anyway, plans for an anti-Margaret Thatcher museum in London. London artists have started a campaign for an anti-Margaret Thatcher museum in an attempt to reclaim her legacy from sycophants like David Cameron and Tony Blair. David Cameron in 2013 gave his backing to a £15 million museum and library as a permanent memorial to Margaret Thatcher, called the Thatcher Centre, and celebrate the Iron Lady's life. However, artist and writer Darren Cullen has decided there should be a counter collection in London. What are your thoughts, Carla, about the legacy of Margaret Thatcher?
I hadn't heard about this story, but I think it's great. It should definitely go ahead.
Martin?
Well, if you think back to the Thatcher era, the three things that she did which were of note was the privatisation of things that shouldn't have been privatised, like the railways and water.
Actually,
and
that
so
was
forth.
Done under the Major government.
That was part of that era. The second thing was the deregulation of the financial markets, which led directly to the crash in 2008. And the third...
Sorry, it was a bailout, not a crash.
All right, you keep arguing with me. There was a contraction in GDP which would have been much worse if the state hadn't stepped in and bailed out the private financial sector, which it did. And the third great achievement of of Margaret Thatcher was the creation and arming of Al-Qaeda, who were armed and trained by our own special forces. Those are her three great legacies to us. Unnecessary privatisation, the creation of Al-Qaeda and the deregulation of the financial services industry. Nothing that she did was of benefit. And when Blair said we must build on some of her good policies, I heard people this lunchtime talking about buying their council houses at a loss to the taxpayer. And there was people obviously getting that deal thought it was a good deal, but in fact it's not a good deal, it's a rubbish deal. And there's nothing that Margaret Thatcher did which did any good for the British economy at all. Nothing.
So you'll be one of the exhibits down at the Anti-Margaret Thatcher Museum, Martin.
Yes.
Okay. Also, there's some more news on the economy. Margaret Ferrier at Prime Minister's Questions pointed out that we're not doing very well, that George Osborne's borrowed over £74 billion this year. So let's have a listen to her.
Yeah. Margaret Ferrier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Since the Chancellor of the Exchequer took control of the public purse, he has utterly failed to get the deficit under control. And to date this year, has borrowed over £74 billion to plug the gap. Or to use the vernacular that his party is fond of using, for a hypothetical independent Scotland, a monumental financial black hole in his books. Is he now likely to breach their own deficit reduction target for the year by somewhere in the region of £9 billion? Will the Prime Minister finally concede? Will the Prime Minister...
Order, I don't wish to be unkind to the Honourable Lady, but I think we've got the gist. Order, that was a polite way of saying that the Honourable Lady had concluded her question. The Prime Minister...
What I would say is that my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, and the economic strategy this government has pursued has cut the deficit in half from the record level that we inherited, and soon it will be down by two-thirds, and we're meeting what we want to see in terms of debt falling as a share of our GDP. Now, what a contrast, I would say, with a situation that Scotland would be facing if Scotland had voted for independence in just 6 weeks' time. We've actually seen a collapse of 94% of the oil revenues. Now, because we've got the broad shoulders of the United Kingdom, that collapse in the oil price and the taxation won't affect people in Scotland. But had Scotland been independent, it would be a very, very dark day indeed.
Martin, it's David Cameron talking about the broad shoulders of the United Kingdom, actually making quite a good point that Scotland needs us because the oil price is tumbling.
Well, the question of whether Scotland should be independent or not is a separate question from the management of the economy. What George Osborne said when he first came to power is that they would reduce the deficit to zero in one parliament. He didn't do that because what happened is what people have got to realise is that managing the macroeconomy is quite an art. If you try to reduce the deficit too quickly, what you do is you push the economy down and the deficit goes up. In other words, there's a limit to how rapidly you can reduce a deficit. And in actual fact, the Tories have ended up reducing the deficit on about the same timescale as the previous Labour government said they would do. But of course, everybody presumes that's... But of course, what's going to happen when the crash happens, possibly this spring, the deficit will explode because there's no other way for it to happen. That's what will happen as tax receipts collapse and payments on benefits go up. And at that point, the whole policy of the government will be revealed for what it is. It's a scam by fraudsters, effectively.
A couple more changes to the benefits or benefits stories this week, Carla. Ian Duncan Smith is accused of writing a blank cheque to lawyers to defend the bedroom tax in court. This is after the government decided to appeal the Court of Appeal's ruling about the bedroom tax to do with disabled people and women who are fleeing violence, saying that actually they weren't entitled to spare rooms. Also, another story, over 12,000 blind people have had their social care taken away as a result of the cuts. It does seem the picture is that all of the social provision to look after the most needy in society is just going off a cliff.
Yeah, I was really pleased to hear the result of that court ruling and really shocked by the government's immediate response to it. I thought that the brave people who took that to court were really spot on. And you're right, the cuts are increasingly affecting the people that can least afford it. I had a meeting, not just myself and a bunch of other councillors, had a meeting with the Bristol Disability Equality Forum a few months ago, and they told us about the scary situations they were facing in Bristol too.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, in the marginal constituencies, which will decide the next election, people are being allowed to buy houses at less than their real cost in order to cement them as potential Tory voters. That is the reality. I heard people at my place of work in a school discussing buying their council houses today and estimating how much money they would get from that. Tens of thousands of pounds of free money for those people. and at the same time other people are being told that we haven't got enough money for them to have a spare bedroom even if they're blind. There's no justice in any of that. And of course it also underpins the electoral system whereby we're eventually moving towards householders only being able to vote, which of course was the underlying cause of the war in Northern Ireland 30 years ago.
Okay, our last clip from Prime Minister's Questions. Charlotte Leslie, Bristol MP, was talking about radicalisation going on in our prisons.
Charlotte Leslie!
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Our prisons can still be centres of radicalisation. Will the Prime Minister look at all measures, including those in the all-party boxing report, of preventing young people, troubled young people, from falling into the jaws of these dangerously screwed-up predatory extremists?
Yeah. Well, my honourable friend is absolutely right. It is very disturbing that when people are in our care, when the state is looking after them, that on some occasions they have been radicalised because of what they've heard in prison, either from other prisoners or from perhaps even visiting imams. So we need to sort this situation out. The Justice Secretary has put in place a review. I'll look very carefully at the report that she says, but we must make sure that if anything, when people go to prison, if they're already radicalised, they're de-radicalised rather than made worse.
Well, al-Baghdadi was held, who's supposedly the head of ISIS, was held in prison by the Americans in Iraq. Many people believe he was recruited by the Americans while he was in prison in Iraq. In actual fact, as the Russian General Staff have pointed out, most of the jihadis that are operating in the Middle East have been recruited by Western intelligence services like the Turkish MIT and the Saudi Arabian Mukhabarat, our allies.
Do you think this is a real danger, radicalisation in prisons, Carla?
I can't comment that much, I'm afraid. I don't know much about the prison system, so I wouldn't want to speculate.
Fair enough. Martin, let's hear from you again on this then, because there is, I mean, we'll be talking in part two about General Leonid Ivashov, who doesn't believe there's any kind of real international terrorism. He believes it's all cooked up by the West. Anyway, we'll talk about that in part two. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, Green Councillor for Clifton East,
this
Carla Denyer. Back after the Murdoch News at 6.
93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
Normally get you a car, but I've run out of time.